Welcome to the podcast On Things Above, a weekly discussion and devotion rooted in the Word of God and reaching toward heaven above.
Well, we thank you for listening to our podcast On Things Above as we go through this great cloud of witnesses from Hebrews 11. We hope these are helping you not only to set your mind on things above, but perhaps to think things that you hadn't thought of about these great men and women of faith. That's certainly been the case for me. Jarrett said he already knew all of this. But we're happy today to welcome Jason Moore to our podcast. Jason and Jennifer were with the Southside Church from 1992 through 2003. Jason worked in the preacher training program, and if D. Bowman is my father in the faith, Jason is my big brother. That was during the time when D. was doing a lot of meeting work and working at Florida College. So Jason and I were together quite a bit. And Jason, I never told you this privately, so I'm going to mention it now to the millions who are listening to the podcast. Thousands? You helped me in knowing what it means to be a good Bible class teacher. I used to think that the only way a class was successful was when you got as many people talking as possible. And so after one failed attempt, you asked me how my class went, and I said, well, I was the one that did most of the talking. And you said, well, you're the teacher, aren't you? Doing in the present distress.
Thank you, Bubba. Thank you, Jarrett. It's really great to be a part of what you guys are doing with this podcast and to have this socially distant reunion with the Christians at Southside. We love the people there and miss them. We were so rejuvenated when we were there for the lectures just a short time ago. But we're doing well here, and we're in Chelsea, Alabama. We've been living here for almost 11 years now. It'll be in the fall, and we love the people that we're connected to here. We have been very blessed with our life here, and even in the midst of these times, it's been to bless us just immensely. Both with our circle of family and with our circle of brothers and sisters here.
Well, it's great to hear your voice again. Now, we asked you about the people of Hebrews 11, and you chose Elijah for today. Now, the writer does say in verse 32 that time will fail him to tell of the prophets. And then in verse 37, he was wandering in deserts, which you've connected to Elijah. And so tell our listeners why you chose this prophet.
Elijah is such an extraordinary character who lived in extraordinary times. And he's such a colorful character too. He's one of the few that we hear some description of his apparel. And in fact, he's recognized by Ahaziah in 2 Kings chapter 2. When a messenger comes with a message from the prophet, when they describe the way he looked with his leather girdle and that he was a hairy man, Ahaziah knew exactly who he was. And so he's a colorful character. But at the same time, despite his extraordinary faith and his extraordinary work as a prophet during the times of Ahab, he's also a quite relatable character. Mostly because his circumstances were so very, very helpless and destitute. He was a poor man, lived a lot of time alone, and yet he had such an extraordinary faith in the midst of such difficult circumstances. And so it's that part of him that makes him, that part of a circumstance that makes him so relatable to us.
He came on the scene at a very crucial time in the history of God's people, where they were turning to Baal worship, especially through King Ahab. and his wife Jezebel. So tell us and take us back to his story that we may learn more about this great man of faith. Jason?
Sure. In framing my remarks about Elijah, I was thinking in particular about the whole cloud of witness language that's a part of Hebrews chapter 11, and how all of the characters that are a part of this cloud of witnesses that surround us and that watch us as we are on our own faith journey and on our own faith run, they all testify by their own story to how faith is, the walk of faith is doable. They model for us what it looks like. And so it's as we run, we get to draft behind these characters of faith who've come before us. So I was just thinking about how it is that Elijah's faith in particular testifies to us, what his life bears witness to about our own faith journey. And the first thing that occurred to me in terms of Elijah's testimony to faith is that he is a witness to the prayer of faith. Ironically, we're actually not, when we're introduced to Elijah, it's in the context of what James tells us in James chapter 5 was a prayer that he prayed that God would cause it not to rain. What we read in 1 Kings chapter 17 was that Elijah, as a prophet, went and spoke to Ahab and to the people and said that it would not rain for several years until a message would come back from him that God was going to send rain. And we only learn from James that what prompted that drought was Elijah's prayer, that he spoke to God and he asked for God to refrain, to cause it not to rain. And so God, in response to Elijah's prayer, caused a drought that occurred for 3.5 years. And the thing that I find so powerful and motivating in that consideration for us as people of faith is this, and we can, like Elijah, you know, see what's happening in the world around us and feel a bit helpless to make a difference. Ahab was the king. Ahab had armies that would march at his command. He had a political alliance with the Phoenician king. He had married the Phoenician princess Jezebel. There was great prosperity in the north under the reign of Ahab and his father Omri. There had been war for 60 years between the northern kingdom of Israel and the southern kingdom of Judah, but Ahab had brokered a peace because his daughter Athaliah had married Jehoshaphat's son. And so some could look at the times in which Ahab was reigning and in which Elijah was living and say that, you know, these are the best of times in the days of Ahab. But when Elijah looked at his society, he saw morality crumbling, and he saw how it is that the marriage of Ahab to Jezebel had introduced the worship of Baal, the storm god, to Israel. And so he saw how all of that was resulting in the moral decline and degeneracy of the society around him, and how people, you know, where people were not seeing God and the greatness of God, the greatness of Jehovah. And that was very troubling to Elijah. And so he wanted God to show that Baal, the storm god, was impotent, that he was no god at all. And he had no control over the weather, no control over the storm. And so Elijah prayed that it would not rain, so that Jehovah would show the people that he was the one that was in control of the rain and the crops, and in fact, life itself, that he was the source of their every need, that he alone was the living, was the living God. And so that was the reason for his prayer. And so the affirmation of faith, the testimony that we learn from Elijah, is that ordinary righteous people who pray have the greatest influence over the events of the day. The way that America will be made great again, if America is to be made great again, is by the prayers of righteous people. And righteous people who pray have more influence over over all that's going on in the world, because we have a Father who is also the King, a Most High, and He hears every time His people call. And so when we find ourselves in circumstances where, and they don't have to be on the macro scale of like what's going on in our country, but even in our own family and in our own world and in our own life and in our own workplace, when we find ourselves feeling stuck, Elijah testifies to the fact that we are not stuck, that we have a vote in what's going on around us. And especially when our desires align themselves with the desires of God and what He wants for our family and for our workplace and for the world, Elijah's desires certainly were aligned with God's, because the thing that troubled him most was that people had abandoned faith in him. And so he desired that to come back, and he prayed earnestly that God would do something to revive people's faith in him. And God responded to that prayer. And so I just want to underline how Elijah testifies to the influence that we have over the events in the world, because we have a voice of God, and that ordinary righteous people who pray have greatest influence over the events of the day. And that is a reality of faith. There can be some struggle that accompanies even the life of an extraordinary character like Elijah. And so he, the climax of his prayer for it not to rain comes in 1 Kings, the 18th chapter, where he confronts King Ahab after being in hiding for Elijah's been in hiding for 3.5 years while it wasn't raining. And then in 1 Kings 18, he comes to Ahab, and the result of that conversation is a meeting with Elijah and the 450 prophets of Baal and the 400 prophets of Asherah on Mount Carmel. Ahab is assembles the people, and together with the 450 prophets of Baal and the 400 prophets of Asherah, and there is a contest then. There's the contest then that Elijah proposes, and he does so when all the people are assembled so that like nobody can back out. All the people are there. King Ahab is there. The prophets are there. And the contest he proposes is that they each build an altar and that they call to their God and they see which one answers by fire. And the thing that is striking again about what happens in this contest on Baal, the thing that is striking about what happens with this contest on Carmel is how lopsided it is. Elijah is standing next to an altar that has been broken down for years. And there are 950 prophets that are opposite him. So you just have to imagine the scene, this lopsided scene of one man versus 850 prophets. 850 prophets are opposite him, and they build their altar, or they have their altar to Baal, and they, and they put on a good show. They're crying out, they're worshiping Baal, and yet as the day drags on, they're sweaty, they are bleeding because they've been gouging themselves because Baal hasn't answered. They started early in the morning. By the noontime, you know, nothing has happened. The sacrifices are starting to stink. And so you could just imagine the flies and just the impotency that's shown on the part of Baal. Finally, in the evening, when their voices are raspy and Baal is not answered, then Elijah tells all the people to come closer. And he then takes the 12 stones and rebuilds the altar to God, and prays to God after dousing the sacrifice with 12 pitchers of water, so that the altar and the sacrifice and the ditch around it are running over with water. And when he prays, God answers with fire from heaven, and it consumes the altar, consumes the sacrifice, consumes, licks up all water, and the people are electrified by the fickle people, by what happens there, and confess that Jehovah is God, Jehovah is God. And it looks like it's been a great victory. But what happens next is Ahab gets in his chariot at Elijah's bidding, and he rides furiously back to Jezreel. A thunderstorm comes, and it begins to rain. And so Ahab is driving home in the rain. And Elijah had in his mind this vision of how it was all going to work out. And I think what he thought was going to happen was that there would be this great revival that would happen in response to his prayer and this contest on Carmel, that would be a top-down revival, meaning that it would start with Ahab. Ahab's heart would be changed. And so as a result of his leadership, just like happened under King David, there would be this spiritual revival that would happen in the land. But what happens is Ahab goes back to Jezreel. He tells Jezebel what Elijah has done, and Jezebel swears out a death warrant on Elijah. And Elijah then gets he gets the blues. He gets, and we've all had the Elijah blues. Like, everything I've done has been a failure. It's all I tried and I prayed, and this is what I thought was going to happen, and it didn't happen. And so Elijah then flees for his life. He goes to Mount Horeb, and he goes and sits in a cave and asks for God to take his life. And so he is a witness to that kind of struggle of faith that comes when we try our best and we find that we've failed, or when other people have disappointed us, as was the case with Ahab, disappointed him. And it seems like even God's answer to his prayer was all in vain, because the revival that he thought would happen seems to now be just a wish and not something that's going to be fulfilled.
When James speaks of Elijah's prayer in James 5, he says that Elijah was a man with a nature like ours. He was just like us. And so Yes. We've all been through the struggles that come. Even after great victory, the devil is not going to sit by, but we can, like Elijah, overcome. Well, Jarrett, there are 400 years of silence between the Old Testament and the New Testament. And the last word, the last prophecy made before silence, was about a coming of another Elijah. Tell us about that one.
Right. So just as our Old Testament closes, or at least the way that we have it arranged, in Malachi 3 and verse 1, it says, "Behold, I send my messenger, and he will prepare the way before me, and the Lord whom you seek will suddenly come to his temple." And then the very last two verses of our Old Testament, Malachi 4, verses 5 and 6, "Behold, I'll send you Elijah the prophet before the great and awesome day of the Lord comes, and he will turn the hearts of the fathers to their children and the hearts of their children to their fathers, lest I come and strike the land with a decree of utter destruction." So just before we have those 400 years of silence, the last words ringing in our ears is that someone just like Elijah will come before the Messiah. And the new Elijah will do two things. One, he'll prepare the way for the Lord. He'll make way for the king. And then number two, he'll turn the hearts of the fathers to their children and the children to their fathers. In other words, I think it's saying he'll start the process where every household, all people, fathers and children alike, will turn their hearts toward God, the ultimate father. And so as we open our New Testaments, that's what Israel is searching for, not just the Messiah, but the one who would come before him, the new Elijah. And if we think about it for a moment, the new Elijah, it sounds, right off the bat, sounds a lot like John the Baptist. The comparison kind of jumps out to you. The way they dress, their lives of solitude out in the wilderness, their boldness to preach God's word, even in great opposition, the persecution that they receive from the king of the land and the conspiracies that go into that. Their lives looked similar in so many different ways, the suffering, the struggle, the hardship to accomplish God's purpose. But before we even read about any of that, the beginning of the story is in Luke 1, beginning in verse 13. "Don't be afraid, Zechariah, for your prayer has been heard, and your wife Elizabeth will bear you a son, and you shall call his name John. And you will have joy and gladness, and many will rejoice at his birth, for he will be great before the Lord. And he must not drink wine or strong drink, and he will be filled with the Spirit, even from his mother's womb. And he will turn many of the children of Israel to the Lord their God. And he'll go before him in the spirit and power of Elijah to turn the hearts of the fathers to the children and the disobedient to the wisdom of the just, to make ready for the Lord a people prepared." So just as the last pages of our Old Testament promised, this angel announces that the new Elijah is John the Baptist, and he will accomplish those two things promised in Malachi. And that's exactly what he goes on to do throughout his ministry. His constant message is repent, change, turn your heart, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand. Make way for the king. And this is really, I think, the greatest parallel between John and Elijah. They both turn the hearts of the people back toward God, or at least they start that process, and they prepare the way for someone who is greater. And that's exactly how our lives should be, constantly looking to turn our own hearts and the hearts of the people around us toward God and preparing the way for someone who is far greater than ourselves. And maybe we'll feel like outcasts. Maybe we'll go through times of persecution or hardship where we kind of feel like we're isolated in our own desert. But between Elijah, who is taken up into heaven, and John, of whom Jesus said there's no one born greater, that leaves us in pretty good company as we live our lives in humble service to the one whose sandals we're not even worthy to untie. Or like John said himself, and like Elijah exemplified throughout his life, every day he must increase and I must decrease.
We've all had those conversations where we just pick up right where we left off. It's as if after 400 years, the Lord says, as I was saying, here comes the new Elijah. Well, Jason, you've told us about the prayer of faith and the struggle of faith. How else would you like us to think of Elijah today?
Sure. I want to give some resolution to this whole business of the struggle of faith that Elijah experienced, because certainly that's a reality. We see that pattern in all of the witnesses of faith that are found in Hebrews chapter 11. They all had some kind of, and maybe not just one, but they had struggles with their own personal faith. And when Elijah comes to Mount Horeb, he's asked God to take his life, and he's hiding in the cave there. God calls Elijah to come out of the cave, and he says that the Lord is passing by, and there's four experiences that happen. There's a whirlwind so strong that it's even breaking the rocks around him. There is an earthquake. There's a fire. And it says that God, this is in 1 Kings, the 19th chapter, and that the Lord was not in either the whirlwind or the earthquake or the fire. But then there's this gentle blowing breeze, and God speaks to him out of the gentle breeze, and he asks Elijah, "What are you doing here?" And Elijah says, "You know, I'm the only one that's left. I'm the only one that believes in you. I'm the only one that They've killed your prophets. They've torn down your altars, and I alone am left. And they're seeking my life. And the thing that the Lord shows Elijah in all of that is that God doesn't have just one, you know, he doesn't have just one card he can play. There's not just like one trick up his sleeve. Sometimes he does answer with fire from heaven and burn up the altar and lick up the water. But sometimes he has other ways of accomplishing his purpose. And Elijah's vision of how things ought to work out was not aligned and could not be, because there's no way for him to see it, with how God was actually going to work it out. And God was working it out in a bigger way. Elijah imagined a top-down spiritual revival that would happen in Israel that would be led by the king, and he would be the prophet next to the king, and there would be this Baal's religion would all be stamped out, and there would now be a national religion that would all be centered around the worship of Jehovah once again. And what God reveals then to Elijah in 1 Kings 19, and what ends up playing out over the course of his life and the course of his mentee, Elisha, who takes his place, is that really what God develops within Israel is a nation within a nation, a remnant of people who have a faith that is so resilient that they don't care what King Ahab says, and they don't care if the national religion is the worship of Baal. They are going to be faithful no matter what. And so Elijah wanted people's faith to be resurrected and for people's faith to be revived, and starting with the king. And what God did instead was to cause a grassroots revival that occurred, because as he says to him there in 1 Kings chapter 19, look, Elijah, there are 7,000 people who've not bowed their knee to Baal. And that's the kind of faith that I'm looking for, is a faith that will trust in me, come what may. And that's what God was growing in his people. The only way that God can grow our faith or gift us with any virtue that is desirable is for God to test our faith. And so God, in allowing Elijah to go through the Elijah blues, that's a part of growing his faith. But part of growing the faith of Israel was to also allow their faith to be tested when it was illegal, when it was outlawed to worship God. And that's how he grew within the ranks of the Israelites, a faith that was real and a faith that was personal. That's how he's going to do it with us too. And so the struggle of faith is uncomfortable, but it's the way that God makes the faith in us that's real, is allowing that faith to be tested. That ties to the last thing that I want to say in terms of Elijah and his, how he's a witness to faith. And that is that Elijah is a witness to the reward of faith. He's a witness to the reward of faith. Hebrews 11 verse 6 says that those that come to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of those that diligently seek him. We started with talking about this lopsidedness between the life that Elijah was leading and the life that King Ahab was leading. When God sent the drought on Israel, nobody suffered more than Elijah did. King Ahab, when the drought comes to an end 3.5 years later, King Ahab has sent out messengers to go and find water for his donkeys. Like, it's not so that he has something to drink. He's worried about like not shooting his horses. And meanwhile, Elijah, lived by the brook Cherith on the other side of the Jordan River, and that brook dried up. While he was living by the brook on the east side of the Jordan, he was fed by ravens who brought him meat and who brought him bread every day. When the brook dried up, he moved to Zarephath, to Gentile territory. He lived with a widow there and her only son. When he meets the widow, she says that she was collecting sticks to go and bake, their last cake of bread, and that she and her son would then die because of the drought. And Elijah tells her to go and bake a cake, and the three of them will eat it together. And he said that God would make for them a bottomless bowl of flour and an endless supply of oil. And so all the time that the drought was in the land, Elijah and the widow and her son were all preserved by this bottomless bowl of flour and this endless supply of oil that God furnished for them. The thing that Elijah found that is the reward of faith is that he wasn't eating cakes like Ahab was. Ahab lived a life where he had power, he had prestige, he had connections. It looks like he's living the dream. But every day that Elijah wakes up, he is living his life from God, and he's living his life with God. Every day when he gets up for breakfast, you know, there's a flock of birds that come over the mountains, and they set a table for him that God has furnished with bread and meat. And the little brook that's there is a brook that God has furnished for Elijah to drink. And he preserved him through the weakest and most vulnerable of creatures, this widowed woman with their only son. And yet Elijah supplied, you know, during all of that time. And what he discovers in all of the reward that he finds in all of that is God himself. God is there. He seeks God's heart, and what he finds is God's hand helping him, rewarding him, being his supply. Every time Elijah's in need, God shows up. And God shows up in a remarkable fashion. That's the reward of faith. It's the fact that we find when we are living life from God's hand and with God, we find that God is nigh, that God always shows up, that God is always in the wake of faith's weight. He is always in the wake of faith's weight. So he was for Elijah, and so he is, so he will be for us. When Ahab dies in battle in a chariot. He is struck by a random arrow from a soldier who is a Syrian, and he bleeds out in the chariot. They take the chariot after they bury him, and they wash it out in the pool of Samaria where the harlots bathed, and we're told that the dogs licked up the blood from the chariot. When Elijah's life comes to an end, he too is, you know, transported in a chariot, but it's in a fiery chariot, you know, that the fact that God comes and takes Elijah home is a testimony to that, to the truth that he discovered throughout his life, and that is that every time he was in need, God shows up and answers that need with his presence, whether he's in the cave or whether he's by the brook, or even when he's literally in that instance crossing the Jordan even when he's crossing the Jordan and taking his step into the unknown of the after this life, God shows himself to Elijah and rewards his faith with his presence.
That instance at the end of his life, God was in the fire and in the whirlwind as he took him up to heaven.
Absolutely.
Jarrett, there is an instance in the New Testament where Elijah is standing on a mountain and he's having a very interesting and curious conversation. Tell us about that.
The Transfiguration is one of those events that in all three of the Synoptic Gospels, but in Mark's account, it sort of ends with this statement. And suddenly, looking around, they no longer saw anyone with them but Jesus only. So we'll hit pause on that thought and jump back to it in a second. But if you go back to chapter 8, leading up to this moment where Jesus is transfigured, we see that it all starts with a question. Jesus asked the disciples, "Who do people say that I am?" And the apostles say, well, some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah. So again, we see that connection with John and Elijah. But then Jesus cuts to the chase and he asks them the most important question that we could ever answer. And that is, who do you say that I am? Who do you say Jesus is? And Peter, he speaks up and he gets it right. He says, "You are the Christ, the Son of God." That's that great confession. But immediately following that, Jesus starts to tell them of how he'll suffer and die and be raised. And Peter, he speaks up again. And he says, "No way, you know, I'm not going to let that happen." And Jesus rebukes him, "Get behind me, Satan, for you are setting your mind on the things of the earth and not on the things of God." And then he goes on to say, "Anyone who wishes to come after me must deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me." And then right after that comes the transfiguration, this amazing scene with Moses and Elijah representing the law and the prophets. And you wonder what they spoke to Jesus about. You wonder what that conversation was like. Maybe one day we'll know. But in that moment, Peter, he speaks up again, and this time he gets it wrong, but he says, "Hey, you know, let's build three tents. Let's build three temporary dwelling places." And as if, you know, they're all equal. And it's almost like God cuts him off mid-sentence. And as Jesus is transfigured in this shining, glorious, brilliant radiance, he says, "This is my beloved son, listen to him." And that brings us back to that verse. And suddenly, looking around, they no longer saw anyone but Jesus only. And I think that's the point. The whole time, even back to when he asked them, "Who do you say that I am?" What they needed to see and what we need to see is Jesus only, not Jesus and Moses and Elijah or some other person as if he's equal to anyone on this earth, but Jesus only, the greater Elijah. Whether transfigured on a mountaintop in brilliant glory or crucified on a hillside in brutal agony, they were to take their mind off the things of the earth and set their mind on the things of God, to fix their eyes on Jesus and Jesus only. It reminds me of the song we sing, "Turn your eyes upon Jesus, look full in his wonderful face, and the things on earth will grow strangely dim in the light of his glory and grace."
Many of the Bible names have the name of God in them, either El for Elohim or IAH for Jehovah. Elijah is one of those rare double names. His name, literally, "My God is Jehovah." May his testimony of faith cause us to say these same words in every circumstance. There are only three people of the Old Testament mentioned more in the New Testament than Elijah: Moses, Abraham, and David. Guess what our next three episodes will be. We hope you can join us. In the meantime, I'm going to ask Linda Shales to write a new hymn called "The Elijah Blues." Thanks, everybody. We'll see you next time.